Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Are you a hippie?
Well, you might say so. Right on. You're beautiful. Let me tell you something, baby. You must have heard of the Vietnam War. They turned me into a murdering machine. Ah! Now you know why I bum around, trying to run away. Run away from this stinking world. A push on the button and we are forced to run to our deaths. A push on the button and we shoot people. A push on the button and we are turned into wild animals. Next time I see you, I'll bust your ugly faces open. I'm looking for a place far away from everything. A place where I can live with a bunch of people who think like me. An absolute free life in an absolutely isolated place, far away from this civilization and culture of violence. Without clothes, without governments, and without orders. I know these creeps, they're after me.
Murderers!
From now on, we're one family. We'll be free.
Freedom! Free! The only sounds that are coming out of this place will be those of song, joy, and laughter! Man, how does it feel to be completely free at last? Man, I feel really turned on. World, you're so full of shit. You're so badly contaminated that it's impossible to find a corner free of smell.
Sharks! Sharks!
What's going to happen to us now?
Shit. This is a really bad scene. We're in a very serious situation. All these bloody creeps around. Isolated island. No food, nothing, no water. The girls will go mad.
We're going to dry up in the sun. We are going to rot away.
You're going too far, baby.
Don't give me any more of your bullshit.
Cool it.
Big shit.
Shut your ass.
I hate you!
The day of reckoning will come.
I'll kill ya!
He will murder you! Let me go!
Yeah! You will be doomed. You will destroy yourself with your own hands. You fools. Stop pushing buttons.
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and he's Rob St. Mary.
That's right. I'm glad to be here. But, Mike, can you keep that patchouli stench down to a minimum? Thanks.
Joining us this week is Yaniv Edelstein.
Shalom lekulam, mein inim.
I don't understand you, man. This week we're talking about an American hippie in Israel. Originally released as The Hitchhiker, this film from 1972 was written, directed, produced, edited, and maybe even catered by Amos Sefer. It's the story of Mike the Hippie, no relation. He's been kicking around Europe since he got home from the war. Now he's in a new land that pretty much goes unnamed during the movie, but we can infer from the new title that it's Israel. Mike hooks up with Elizabeth, Como, and Francois and some other hippies, singing songs and doing other hippie things before the four of them head out on the road, ending up on a remote island where things start to go bad. I should also mention that Mike is plagued by a couple of pasty white dudes in black suits who pack machine guns, of course. Listeners may not know what the movie Black Shampoo means to me. It's kind of my Rocky Horror and my The Room all rolled into one. Yaniv, would it be safe in saying that this movie is kind of your Black Shampoo?
I guess if it's about a movie that's really cringeworthy and very, very weird, and yet you can't stop watching it. You're compelled to watch it again and again. Is that what it is for you with Black Shampoo?
That would be pretty close to it, yeah. Definitely. I think that's more of The Room for me, I suppose, which is something that is kind of bad, but you're fascinated by it at the same time.
Right. You have to be a special kind of person, I guess, also to actually want to do it to yourself over and over again.
Rob, you had some very strong reactions when you first watched this film. We were talking about it via Facebook, and I'd love to get the lowdown from you on those initial reactions.
Well, you know, the thing that's kind of hard for me is to talk about this movie in front of someone who loves it, because I know that no matter what I say about its merits, they're just going to – it's like being addicted to something. And I understand that, because I have my addictions as well in terms of
There's nothing
films.
You could possibly say that would offend me, I don't think, about this film.
I just think it would make a great 45-minute short. There's just some of the stuff, and it just goes on way too long.
Maybe half an hour.
Some of the stuff is, like, I can understand why you're, like, looking at it. It's really fascinating. And it has this, like, weird combo mix for me where there's some really good symbolic stuff. I think the opening's really good, where you have this field, and there's a steamroller rolling over flowers, and then there's these war sounds, and then you get the idea that this is maybe all flashback inside of Mike's head. And I was like, that's really good. And then that sort of sets up this further weirdness that comes out as the film continues to roll on. So I really sort of appreciate that. For me, the only thing that kind of got old after a while was all like the singing and dancing and, you know, just general hippie stuff, which was just annoying to me after a while.
Yeah, I like that it's the singing and dancing that gets old to you, but like, were you fine with the island stuff where they're just kind of wandering around?
Yeah, I mean, to me, that didn't bother me so much, because it's after a while, a lot of the stuff that's in here started to remind me of, and I bring him up all the time because he's a huge figure for me, is like Luis Buñuel, you know, where you have sort of these communication breakdowns, you have these weird symbolisms, you know, the use of the lamb that they're dragging around all over the place that can have several different meanings. And we can get all into that later in terms of some of the different symbolisms that I see in the film.
What I think is interesting is that he was almost Sefer. First of all, he was like an outsider guy who I don't think had advice from anybody about making this film, and made a very singular thing. But the other interesting thing is that he was influenced both by like exploitation stuff and Roger Corman and stuff like that, and then also by stuff like Antonioni, maybe Buñuel. It's this weird mix of exploitation, popcorn drive-in kind of stuff, and European artsy art cinema kind of stuff.
When Mike gets into this unnamed land, Israel, he's wandering around and, you know, hooks up with Elizabeth and all this. Yeah, it does feel very exploitation-ish, you know, as far as, hey, let's get together, let's take off our clothes real quick, have some sex. But there are some those amazing speeches that he gives right before that, where he's talking about, you know, having to push these buttons and all that kind of stuff. That's just like takes it to a little bit of a different place. It's almost a little bit of a preview of what we're going to get as we go further into the film.
It's almost like a Tyler Durden kind of looking directly into the camera and telling the audience, stop pushing buttons.
I killed with my bare hands. I was like an animal. That's the way I was taught to behave. You understand? I was ordered. I was forced to do things I didn't want to do. They turned me into a murdering machine. You understand? Me at 19, a murdering machine. I killed God knows how many. Buddies of mine died right next to me, gasping their last breath with, why? Why do we have to die here? Now you know why I bum around, trying to run away from this stinking world, from the society that turns us into messengers of doom, into robots. A push on the button and we are forced to run to our deaths. A push on the button and we shoot people. A push on the button and we are turned into wild animals. You fools. Stop pushing buttons. You fools. Fools. Fools.
The thing that's interesting that you talk about it being sort of this mashup, and I can see it where you could say, okay, this was informed by something maybe like The Trip or those late 60s American counterculture films that were made real cheap. And then with the whole island scene to some extent, I don't know why, but I was getting like La Ventura flashbacks, you know.
I get that too, yeah.
And then the lamb thing just keeps bringing up Buñuel to me, because like lambs just appear like all the time in Buñuel stuff. So, and then the two guys who keep showing up and kind of haunt him, actually, I can't quite figure out, and I don't think they're supposed to be explained to some extent as to who exactly they are, but they kind of look like undertakers, and they look like ghosts, and that kind of reminded me of like Carnival of Souls, where this man keeps showing up and at certain points and sort of pushes that character in a direction, which makes it interesting to me in the one scene where they've gathered sort of their commune of people, and he's like being sort of Jim Jones cult leader, David Koresh, we're going off to the island. And then the men show up and massacre everyone except for the two couples. it seems like it takes place in reality, but maybe not at the same time. Because yeah, I don't know about you, but if like 50 people were mowed down in front of me, I might have more of a reaction than, oh, okay, let's just get in the car and drive away.
It's as if like the next sequence, they have like sort of a very short morning period of about like 3 screen minutes. They drive around, you know, drive along very solemnly. And then they, Mike brings it up. We'll just do it for all those who couldn't be with us. And that's it. They're never mentioned again. It is sort of, their memory is sort of exercised and done away with. And then they can basically go ahead and move on with the rest of the movie. I don't know if it's just because they couldn't afford to rent a bus for all the hippies, so they just rented a car and killed everybody except four of them.
I like the way that all the hippies come together, you know, how it's like Mike and Elizabeth walking down the street and they pass by Como and Francois and it's like, oh, hey, let's get together. And then, like, you know, 2 becomes 4, 4 becomes 8, 8 becomes 16, 16 becomes 32, and let's all go into this warehouse and, yeah, sing hippie songs. And so I'm sure that Rob was kind of happy when those guys came in and mowed down all those hippies.
This was made obviously at a time before, like, there was this big battle between, like, punk rock and hippies. I see them as sort of the forerunner of what a lot of punks feel about hippies. So right on. And they win in the end. So I just want to say the men win in the end. The Undertakers win in the end. So, you know, punk rock. There you go. I just thought it was interesting, like some of the lyrics in the songs more than anything, especially the one lyric that to me is a real foreshadowing is, and I wrote it down, it's "Someday they'll pay for taking time to play." Which to me, this whole film and its setup almost seems like it's an anti-hippie movie. Instead of being, you know, sort of with sort of, you know, Billy and Wyatt sort of,
it almost seems... Even though in Easy Rider, the hippies get killed as well.
Yeah, but the thing is in this, it almost seems like with that little thing at the end, it's almost, right, to me going, you're doomed. Like, it doesn't matter what your ideals are, you're doomed. And I was just like, that's great. You know, it's really kind of dark.
You know, there's a few clues, you know, that you can look into. Like in the dream sequence, you have these two giant tape recorder people.
I love the dream sequence. The dream sequence is awesome.
The dream sequence is so insane. It's so nuts. And so you have, if you notice, you have, obviously it's much better, easier to see in the film version. It's very clear. Yours was a bit blurry, but you have the two tape recorder people in the suits, which are sort of parallel to the two mimes or whatever you want to call them. And then in the middle, they have this spherical chessboard with pieces, with human pieces on it. You can't quite tell, but the little pieces are like human, and they might be the characters in the film or different people that the tape recorder people are manipulating on the board. At the very least, it's Mike's dream, but also maybe they control things, they control everything that happens, or they represent greater forces in the world. That's one of the things that I like, and the obvious like influence of art cinema is that he wanted to give you something open-ended, something with that doesn't give you all the answers and leaves you coming out of the theater and philosophizing and thinking about what you just saw.
I think that also, I mean, if we wanted to read into sort of where they end up going, we find that the idea is to sort of get away from society and get away from technology. By the time they're on the island, it's almost like they're cavemen, they're primitive. So you could see that as the destruction of technology. We could go back to like the Greeks or something, and these are the fates, as you were saying, who are manipulating everything. The island to me is really interesting, and especially how Mike's character continues to progress and becomes this, like I said, almost this David Koresh, Jim Jones-esque cult leader. You know, he gets people into the speeches and they start speechifying with him, if that's actually a word.
World, you are a world of contempt. You are a meek world. You are a bad world. Bad, bad. Good riddance to bad rubbish.
Once they get to the island, there's this whole sort of shift with communication and sort of breakdown of society. This is why I find that it's sort of anti-idealism to what he was trying to get to, a place where it was like no more violence and we're all going to work together and utopian and stuff like that, is that it almost seems that the filmmaker saying that at its core, we are primitive, we are violent, we are things. And it's like we can't get away from it no matter how much we want to.
Yeah, and I wonder how much, I might be reading way too much into this, but you know, everybody speaks English in the film except for Como. And there's that wonderfully, painfully long scene of Mike and Como trying to talk to one another, even though they can't understand each other at all.
Maybe we should explain this to people who haven't seen it.
Yeah, there's a scene on the island where they kind of go off on their own, and they're talking about how they can get off the island, and they're speaking to each other, and Mike's trying to explain, you know, because there are, you know, hey, the island's only just a little bit away from the mainland, and that's where their car is, except there's a pair of sharks that are out there, that are one big one.
No, there's two of them.
Yeah, he's just like, hey, I want to go swim, but you know, there are the sharks out there, and Koma's just like, I don't understand what you're saying, but he's saying that in
his language,
Hebrew,
right,
and you get, I love the subtitles, because the subtitles on the print that you showed us was, you know, English
and French, or Hebrew and French, yeah, depends who's talking, right.
And then just kept like bouncing back and forth. You would always get one language or the other, or two languages at the same time, and yeah, they just keep talking to one another, and
the scene goes on for
an
eternity.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if that's like this kind of, you know, hey, if we all spoke the same language, man, maybe we could all understand one another.
Yeah, but maybe we could have also gotten that message after 15 seconds. I'm not sure we needed the full 4 minutes, because we know one of the rituals is during the screenings is timing that scene. When that scene starts, people are like, okay, synchronize watches. We're going ahead with this. And then we go into this scene, and it actually goes on for 4 minutes. It sounds maybe, but it feels like about an hour. It just goes on and on. And many things, like at yesterday's screening, my friend Na'ama, who's a sign language interpreter, got on stage and just interpreted the whole thing for the deaf and hard of hearing. Close to the end, there's this part where they all seem to just lose their verbal skills altogether, and all they can do is grunt. They can't talk anymore. They become like cave people, and they just grunt at each other.
Yeah, and I think that scene where Como and Mike are talking to each other, or trying to talk to each other, is almost, you know, a predecessor to that loss of language that we're getting altogether. But I don't know if Como could understand Mike through the rest of it. He just seemed to be kind of happy, and, you know, you know, Francois would translate occasionally to him, or he would ask, how do I say this kind of stuff? And she would let him know.
That's why Como sort of steals all his scenes, because he's just a happy-go-lucky guy who doesn't really care and just along for the ride. He just gets mad applause. And also, the actor who portrays Como is there at all the screenings always. Shmuel Wolf, he's a great guy. He turned 78. He's at the top of his game, and he's just always there. And he answers people's questions and everything after the screening.
Does he get up and go, wonderful feeling?
Everybody else does.
That whole thing, once again, on sort of the symbolism level, and maybe it's because I'm trying to read this into it because, okay, it's Israel. We're thinking, you know, Old Testament, Torah, things like that. Like Tower of Babel kind of thing, you know, where it's like people can't talk anymore. Communications break down, you know, people are fighting with each other because they can't get on the same page. Maybe I'm going too far on it, but
I think that was totally what they meant. Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back after a few words from our sponsors.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that f***ing burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you. The worst acting piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, God. Oh, that was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
Ahoy, mateys. This is K.A.B., Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. K.A.B.
Projection booth, and we're talking once again to Yaniv Edelstein about An American Hippie in Israel. Now, we hear that music. How did sort of this music come about? I mean, were these people who were just sort of friends of the filmmaker? Were they sort of known quantities in Israel? Sort of, let's talk about some of these songs.
Well, the guy who did the music is Nachum Heyman, who's a very famous songwriter over here, was at the time and still is. And he basically did the music and the song, the one song that plays on the soundtrack. This song goes on for also an unbearable amount of time and has a seemingly endless number of verses in English. There's also the hangar scene with Susan and Fran, who perform a song in its entirety for the partying hippies. And they wrote and performed that song. I interviewed them as well. They're still around, Susan and Fran. They're living in the States and Canada. And Susan visited Israel and also participated in one of our screenings and performed the same song before the movie. It's really cool because for a lot of these people, including them, this movie was basically just a lost weekend or something that they participated in and totally forgot about. And it was never released. So they just considered it lost or were deeply ashamed of it and were hoping it never came back. For some of them, it came back, and bit them. Some of them were some of the people who participated and were sort of embarrassed at first, but I think all of them got past it and are basically really just enjoying the success that it's having now and getting a kick out of it.
Let's kind of talk about that. I mean, how did you uncover it, and then how did it sort of spread to become a cult item over there in Israel?
The first I ever heard of it was on YouTube, where I was just looking for something else and it popped up as a suggestion, An American Hippie in Israel. I'm from Israel and it looked interesting, and I'm into movies in the 70s, so I clicked on it and I saw this trailer, which is still available. It's a terrific trailer, and I was very intrigued. I tried Googling it and looking it up, and there was no information anywhere. There was no IMDb page, there was no Wikipedia, there was nothing, except for I think one or two places where people are asking as well, what is it, where can I get it, anybody know anything about it? And I didn't know what to do. I looked everywhere and I couldn't find anything, so I luckily knew one of the people in the trailer, who's Shmuel Wolf. I just recognized his face. He's a very recognizable guy. I know him from other things that he did. And I just called information and asked for his number and just called him up as a stranger and said, look, my name's Yaniv. And I just came across this thing that has you in it from the 70s with bikinis and sharks and all sorts of crazy stuff going on, and do you know what this is? And he just immediately knew exactly what it was, and he told me all about it. And it turns out, yeah, it's a film that was shelved, that never found a distributor. They just made it on spec. Israel didn't have much of a film industry anyway, but it wasn't made with any kind of a studio or anything. It was just a movie that a guy just made. A guy just found money for and just made and could never find a distributor. So it's been on the shelves in the archives. It was shot in 1971. It's like supposed completion date is 1972, but it never screened anywhere. But luckily, Shmuel Wolf had a copy of it at home on VHS. He's a collector or of sorts, and he made sure to have a copy of it. So, and that's the same copy that you got, that you saw. As soon as I got that from him, I obviously was extremely excited, but I held off. I didn't watch it. And I organized a screening where I knew a friend of mine, and in this place in Tel Aviv, they were having a weekly movie night just in a place which isn't exactly a private house, but it's close to being a private house. It's basically a cross between an art gallery, an office space, and somebody's house. And they were just showing a movie every week. So I said, let's make one about this. So we just invited people, made an event on Facebook, which was new at the time in 2007. And there was a lot of interest. The place was packed with about 50 or 60 people, which was as much as it can contain. And I held off on watching it and just waited. Everybody came in. Shmuel Wolf came with his wife and his friends. And Nachum Eiman, the soundtrack guy, the score composer, was there. And a lot of other people. And we just all watched it together. Shmuel Wolf also had never seen it in its entirety. Nobody had seen it. Even the people who were in it never saw it. They never got the chance. Shmuel Wolf actually told me that they screened the film at the Cinematheque in the 1980s. And he attended and he showed up, and when the audience started cracking up and laughing, he was too embarrassed and he left in the middle. So he actually never saw it. So 35 years later, after making it, everybody was primed, everybody was ready, or so we thought. We knew it was going to be campy and not very good and fun or something. But everybody was surprised, not least of which me, at that screening, because nothing can prepare you for this movie, really. The trailer can show you that it's hippies and all this stuff, but the weirdness of this film is unexpected, I think. The trailer was made by Bob Murawski, who was an Oscar-winning editor, so he did a terrific job and made a really good trailer, which looks exciting and interesting. No, the trailer doesn't prepare you for a movie where, like, minutes go by and there's no dialogue and all this really weird stuff that just leaves you scratching your head, you know. So that's a whole other aspect of it. So it started with the fact that it was very rare and intriguing, and that's what got it to a screening and interest. Okay, but then later we found a film print, a 35mm film print of the film that was just gathering dust in the archive. And we screened it at the Cinematheque for a proper, you know, ticket-buying audience. And also, once you saw, this movie just works with an audience in a way that I never saw with any other film. I didn't think there would be more than one screening, or at the most two or three screenings. But very soon it became apparent that not only is there demand for people to wanted to watch it, people who already watched it wanted to come back and watch it again and again. And actually, there's like a hardcore of fans that had just come every single month, never miss a screening.
So how many times do you think you've seen the film in a theater?
Well, look, we're numbering them. It's going to be 2 years soon of monthly screenings in Tel Aviv. And it was the 22nd screening last night. I missed one of those, I must say, but I saw it 21 times in Tel Aviv and I think three more times in Haifa. So at least 24, 25 times, yeah.
Are people under the influence of substances when they come to see this multiple times?
Well, it helps. But this movie itself is a pretty strong substance. This movie puts you in a very bizarre state of mind.
So how did the screening go last night?
It actually was terrible because there was technical difficulties. The Wi-Fi didn't work and the 35mm projector just died. We were always on the lookout for the print to finally deteriorate and just fall apart. So that thankfully hasn't happened yet, but the projector died.
Man.
We ended up screening basically the same crappy file that I sent you. So that's basically what we screened. A little bit better because yours was a little compressed, but basically that. But nobody seemed to mind. It was unbelievable. The screening was supposed to start at midnight. There was like half an hour, 40 minutes of, you know, running around with the projectionists, unpacking and trying to do all sorts of, you know, equipment and stuff. And the final movie, only like when we got everything going to even screen from a laptop, it took 40 minutes. It was 12:40 a.m. And we went into the theater and we said to everybody, look, there was about 50 people there, I think. And we said, look, we're sorry, the projector died and we can only screen this in really crappy quality. And the sound might go off at any moment. So we're letting all the cashiers go now. So if anybody wants their money back, go now and get your money back. Otherwise, go ahead. And nobody left.
Wow.
Wow.
Everybody stayed.
How did you get on the radar of Grindhouse Releasing and them saying, you know, we're interested in doing something with it?
I can't remember who contacted who first. But obviously we were kindred spirits by being connected with this film, because Bob Murawski from Grindhouse has been obsessed with this film for 25 years by his own admission. That's what he says. And his story, the real obsessed party, the real person who's really obsessed with this is Bob, because he's been obsessed with American Hippie in Israel before he ever saw it. It took him a couple of years where for him it was just a movie title, and he was obsessed with the movie title and really wanted to watch it and couldn't. And it took him a while to... Finally, he got to see just the last reel of the film and was blown away just by that. So you can imagine how it just grew and grew for him, and eventually obtained the rights to the film and created the trailer, as I said, and he'll be releasing it.
You had mentioned Bob as a, you know, Oscar-winning editor. It's weird. There's this Midwest connection, Michigan connection. He's actually from Bad Axe, Michigan, and he works with Sam Raimi, has for a lot of years. He did the editing on Spider-Man and Army of Darkness, and he's even doing the editing right now on Oz the Great and Powerful.
That's right. He has like a double cinematic life where he's a very like a mainstream respected Oscar-winning guy on one hand, but then on the other hand, he's very interested in grindhouse stuff, gore and weirdness. And actually, if you check out his Oscar acceptance speech for The Hurt Locker, he gets up there and he accepts it, and he thanks Roger Corman. He's a cool guy. He's a very serious guy and very serious about this movie.
I think Grindhouse does a lot of great stuff. They've put out things that I've been able to see at the show here. They've done, I think they did restorations on, speaking of Sam Raimi, I think they did Evil Dead. They cleaned that up, and they continue to put that out to theaters from time to time. So they do a lot of really interesting stuff, and also a lot of the harder Italian stuff. Like, I think they have like Cannibal Holocaust and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. As for the filmmaker himself, Amos Safar, what do we know about him? I mean, did he do anything else beyond this? Or, you know, sort of, have you been able to sort of piece together as to this director and, you know, basically the guy who did everything in relation to the creation of this film? What do we kind of know about him and his history?
I don't know too much about him. I usually joke that it's his first and last film. He directed a couple of shorts, but I've never seen them and I don't know what they are. Supposedly he went to film school in Europe, I believe. And after this, after making this film, basically he went to the States. He left Israel with a copy of the film and succeeded, I think, in selling it to a distributor, even though it never happened. I'm not sure if he sold it or, I mean, there is an American print, but I don't think it actually played in any theaters. And I think he lived out the rest of his life in the U.S. and never came back to Israel. I'm not sure what he did over there. I didn't go too much more into the story of Amos Safar and what became of him in later years. I was more concerned with basically the screenings helping to sort of cultivate this cult around it and this folklore and these active screenings in Tel Aviv and other places in Israel.
What is the thing with Mike riding the camel?
I went and I interviewed a guy who was involved in the production. Basically, Amos Safar just wrote the movie and then found a rich Jew and just persuaded him to fund the movie. And this was apparently a guy who had a lot of money from his family's pillow factory in New Jersey. And he just made Aliyah and just emigrated to Israel, I guess, with his money. Amos Safar, just one-on-one, met him socially, convinced him to back this movie. And this guy just put his life savings into this movie and just went completely bankrupt with this movie that didn't earn $1. And so Moshe Berman was the guy, I don't remember the names, but the guy who financed the film, he was his son-in-law. And he sent him to supervise the production and make sure that the money is being well spent or something. So he followed them to Be'er Sheva and Eilat and the Sinai Peninsula, which is today it's part of Egypt, but at the time it was part of Israel. It was conquered by Israel in 67 and given back in 78. He traveled along with them to the south. And I met up with this guy, and he showed me photos that he snapped, that he took. So Mike riding the camel is just a still picture. It's not part of the film, but it was. It's part of the sequence in the market, in the Bedouin market. And basically, he had a whole bunch of photos just that he and his wife took. And I scanned all those photos, and those will be included in the DVD. There's stuff that you didn't see that's not included in your print. The print that you saw and that we screened has some cuts in it that were made by censors in Israel, by the Israeli censors, which is mostly sex scenes that were cut out. Just here and there, they snipped a few seconds of male butt during a sex scene. Like a censor said, oh, no, we can't have that. You know, like the priest in Cinema Paradiso. Like, so for instance, when the car is driving around and Como and Françoise are having sex in the back seat. So there's another minute of that, of mostly, you know, Como's ass going up and down, you know, in the back seat of the car. And also there's like a group sex scene that happens after the campfire, about 30 or 60 seconds of group sex that's basically in the dark that you can only hear. So it's pretty much you see nothing or just a blanket barely like moving, and it just sounds like the four actors just doing like a bad German porno film dub, the moans and stuff. The thing about this film, okay, originally it was called The Hitchhiker. Israel wasn't a part of the title, and it's never mentioned in the film specifically where it happens, what country it's taking place in. He just calls it like these parts, or I heard about this country, stuff like that. And also something that probably you didn't notice but gets a huge rise out of Israeli audiences is this. You remember in the hangar, Mike says to everybody, so maybe somebody knows of a place we can go, and this one hippie pipes up and says, I know this isolated island about 20 kilometers south of this town, and where they go is Eilat, which is about 400 kilometers south. So it's this very bizarre, like a parallel. I mean, it's not actually supposed to be Israel. They seem to have, shied away from specific references and from Hebrew or anything that identifies Israel as such. I think he wanted it, and obviously it speaks English. I mean, I think he just wanted a movie he thought he would conquer the world with this movie.
But it also kind of gives it that could be anywhere quality.
Well, that's what he was going for. Does it work, do you think?
I think it does, actually. I don't know. What do you think, Rob?
To me, it kind of reminds me, like, especially when they're going through the desert and they have the freak out scenes and all that stuff, and then they end up on the island. It almost kind of reminds me of like the Southwest, like they're driving through, Arizona or something, and there's a lot of sort of, when we talk about American sort of counterculture and hippies and all of that stuff, there's a lot of it in that sort of like Deserts of California thing that gets into our heads. We think of things like, I guess, maybe like the Manson family or something, out in the desert somewhere. So to us, I mean, to me at least, looking at it as an American, looking at it, it could be the American Southwest.
Yeah, and you have this thing of like maybe taking peyote and having a vision in the desert and stuff.
Yeah, I think had we not seen it with the title American Hippie in Israel in mind, just if we had seen it as The Hitchhiker, I think, I could have been, I don't want to say fooled, but I could have just been thinking that it was an American film. But then with the character of Como and him speaking this other language, I would always be saying to myself, what is he speaking, and trying to figure that out? And why is he speaking this other language in whatever area they're at?
I think it really is a case where the title just totally changes your perception of the movie, yeah.
To be honest, most of the interactions of what people would consider from an American point of view, never being to Israel, our sort of cultural understanding of what someone who's Jewish might look like to us would be obviously people with the skull caps on, or, the Orthodox, okay, the Hasids, things like that. So it's like, we're not seeing that in the film either. So it's no obvious sort of connection in that way to the faith that would be sort of symbolic to us over here as well.
Yeah, but look, there's a lot more to Israel than that. Like, I'm from Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is a very secular city that was actually started by secular Jews and who were mostly like socialists and intellectuals. And Tel Aviv, and it existed 40 years before the state of Israel ever existed. In a way, Tel Aviv is kind of separate from the rest of Israel because it's very secular, very modern, very Western. And Amos Sefer came from that milieu. I mean, I think he was like a bohemian Tel Aviv guy with a lot of European influences. And seriously, he, again, without knowing that much about him, and obviously without knowing him personally, was more concerned with Antonioni, I think, probably, Brigitte Bardot, than anything about Judaism or, that kind of thing. The people in the movie are, Shmuel Wolf and Asher Tzarfati are theater actors from Tel Aviv. Lili Avidan, who plays Elizabeth, was famous as the wife of a famous poet and sort of a party girl, that you would read about in the like gossip columns, that kind of thing.
I think my first exposure to even the idea of there being a country called Israel was seeing the Golda Meir TV movie with Ingrid Bergman in it. So that's what I always picture in my head, that and just this kind of arid land. And yeah, you always get the pictures of the guys in front of the Wailing Wall. So we're not picturing this socialist intellectual place, which are two of the most dirty words in America at the moment, by the way. So it's very nice to see this flip side of what we have in our minds as far as this war-torn. This was definitely as far away from that as you possibly could get.
Right, but also it's 1972, and in the late 60s and 70s, Tel Aviv was very swinging, very... you know, you have lots of this footage of parties, miniskirts, all that stuff going on. A lot of European influence, a lot of European stars from France and England coming to Tel Aviv and being on the beach and stuff like that. There's also swinging, artsy, sexy, European-influenced Israeli cinema from the time.
American Hippie is very artful, but it's not the type of ponderous... independent film that we would see at one of our art houses over here now. It would be something that should be shown at a midnight show like you've done over there.
Like I said, it's an interesting mix of things because you have a little bit of exploitation and a little bit of art house and then a lot of space in between. So the thing about this film, seriously, that you can't know without watching it is just how much just empty space it has, which is actually fantastic, very, very conducive for audience participation. So the screenings of this movie are a lot more like a comedy show or stand-up comedy. It's even more than like an MST3K kind of thing where you just make fun of how bad it is. That's part of it. But also there's just so much empty space that you're just compelled to just go on stage and just talk to the audience and just say your piece. You know what I mean? We always make sure to have a live mic in the screenings. And during some of the scenes, you know, okay, the boat disappeared. They're going to go and look for the boat for 2 screen minutes. They're just walking around. There's a song in the background. That's it. So people can go on stage, talk to the audience, have a dialogue, have dance, lecture, talk about a different subject, you know, do anything they want. It doesn't harm the movie. It doesn't interrupt the movie. So it's like a platform, you know, it's like a platform for other things to just go on stage and do other things. While the hippies are dancing, everybody gets up and dances on stage, which is always fun.
I was going to ask, you know, is there any plans in your discussions with Grindhouse to maybe on the Blu-ray or the DVD or something like that to include like a guide, sort of like with Rocky Horror, as to, okay, at this point, get up and do this, or, you know, you should do these kind of things at this point in the film, or have you actually taken some cameras and shot some of the screenings, do a little documentary so that us folks over here in America can get an idea of how insane the crowds are for this film over there?
Yeah, we have a little bit of stuff. We made a couple of extra features for the DVD, so you'll have a featurette, a couple of different featurettes about the craziness that goes on at our screenings. I didn't want it to be like Rocky, because, you know, Rocky Horror, it's this very structured thing now. You have to see this thing at this point and that thing at that point, and it's all very, it's like a whole different, you know, like a parallel set of directions.
It's like a Catholic ceremony, basically.
Exactly. It's like a religious ritual. So it's been going on for almost 2 years. So my guiding principle was to just keep it really free, really loose. It's after midnight. All the adults have gone away and you can just go crazy and do anything you want, and just kept it very, very loose. Now the 2 years have gone by. I have this plan in my head, which I hope will become a reality in October. It's going to be our 2 year anniversary, our 25th monthly screening, and also the 40 year anniversary of the film. So I thought I have plans for making one like real gala special screening. I want to have it not at midnight, but at 9:30 or 10, like a prime time hour, and just have it really structured. So for once, I want it to be really just stage direction, you know, have a host. We had that a little bit. A guy called Uzi Navon, who's a terrific singer from the 70s. And we had a few screenings where he's like a master of ceremonies and he goes up before and during and sings. We have lyrics for all the songs. There's this tune that keeps returning, keeps repeating itself all over the film. And we have lyrics for that. So during the bits where it's just incidental music, he goes up and he sings. He croons these songs. And so I want to do a gala screening with him, with, you know, like a institutional version of all the jokes that usually just get yelled out. Just have them, you know, projected on the screen so everybody can yell them, and have the lyrics projected so everybody can sing along, and all sorts of stuff like that. So hopefully that'll happen in October.
How I wish I could be there to see that, because that sounds awesome.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it could still coincide with the release schedule for the DVD and Blu-ray. You know, maybe not. That's not in my control.
But before we kind of wrap stuff up, I want to say one thing that I think anybody who is a fan of Lost should be watching this film, because I was really reminded, you know, you got this little island and you got sharks swimming around outside of it and you can't get off the island because of the sharks. I was taken to Lost quite a bit. And then, you know, I think it actually has a much more satisfying ending than Lost does.
Maybe they should have, yeah, maybe they should have ripped off that ending.
Yeah, just have those two guys. Yeah, that would be great. Have the lamb there.
Instead of a polar bear, a lamb?
Right.
I'm actually, my day job, I do subtitles, so I actually translated all of Lost for Israeli TV. And Bob asked me to do the subtitles, Hebrew subtitles for the Blu-ray as well. It's kind of weird, you know, because I'm, you know, actually like good movies better, you know? I'm not one of these. I don't have a huge thing of watching bad movies intentionally and watching campy stuff. I usually go more for film festival stuff and art house cinema and, you know, give me probably the Coen brothers and Roman Polanski and, you know, stuff like that. But somehow I became the American Hippie in Israel guy over here. I never thought that I would watch this movie more than once or twice or three times. But it just turned into this thing where it's, you know, I used to think that after a little while, I'd be like, okay, I'd show up, say hello, and watch the first 15 minutes and go home. But I just always get sucked in, and I always have to watch the whole thing and just participate and, you know, yell out my frustration at the frustrating bits and just be in it until the bitter end.
We're going to take a break and play a preview from next week's show.
Big John Taylor, mercenary, soldier of fortune. He's more than a man. He's a walking death machine. Candy O'Perrin, sexy undercover cop. Her deadliest weapon is her body. Mike O'Malley, Hollywood's top stuntman.
What do you want us to do?
Fight our champions.
Only this time, the action's for real. Rick Chan, black belt, primed for action with one blow. The death blow. Only two words describe the power and fury of this unstoppable team. Raw force. Join them as their carefree vacation cruise turns into hell on the high seas.
What was that?
Final port of call. Warrior Island. Uncharted and unexplored.
We should not be here.
Burial grounds for martial arts masters from the past. Their resting place is defiled. They rise from the dead to avenge their honor. Will win, the living or the living dead. Join John Dresden, Gillian Kesner, Jeff Benny, Raymond King, and Cameron Mitchell. As they band together with the incredible power of raw force, untamed and unleashed to kill.
All right, we're back. That was a preview from Raw Force, a.k.a. Kung Fu Cannibals. We'll be joined by a very special guest next week, Mr. Bill Byforce from Outside the Cinema. I want to thank this week's special guest, Mr. Yaniv Edelstein, for taking time to talk to us about An American Hippie in Israel. Yaniv, can you tell some of the things that you do in your homeland when you're not smoking dope, singing folk songs, or battling sharks?
Well, I told you about the subtitle thing. That's my daytime job. Yeah, I mostly do, you know, English into Hebrew for Israeli TV, cinematheques, film festivals, and did a lot of feature films and stuff. And also, well, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of, how should I put this? There's protests in Israel since last year. There's a lot of social unrest, a lot of protests all around the country against how screwed up our government is. I'm not going to go into all the details, but it's sort of maybe akin to the Occupy movement. So I help those guys out a little bit, and I'm, of course, supporting them a lot. And I'm mostly into movies a lot. So outside of working in subtitles, I have a lot of friends who are movie critics. I write a little bit. I attend screenings, arrange screenings, and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah, and it's funny. I think you and I have been talking via email.
That's right. We've known each other online for over a decade. How long has it been? Probably about.
I think so, yeah. I think it probably since 99, 98, something like that.
Do you know how it started? I actually saw a copy of Kashir's Du Cinemart in the Tower Records Records here in Tel Aviv, an actual copy. I don't know if you were that widely distributed all over the globe? I mean,
yeah, well, it was funny. The guy who distributed, who I worked with over there, Clint Johns, he was very cognizant of what he thought would sell in different stores. And, yeah, he was like, okay, well, we'll do two to Cleveland, you know, one to Tel Aviv, one to Osaka. So he's telling me this, like, as we're talking on the phone, and I'm like, okay, I trust you. But he was just like, he was very quick thinker and just trying to come up with all the different places where he thought it would sell and how many copies he would send over there. So apparently he was right. It sold at least one in Tel Aviv.
Right, if it was one to Tel Aviv, that's the one, you know, on my shelf somewhere.
All right.
So there you go. I mean, go figure.
Thanks again for stopping by, Yaniv, and thanks to everyone for listening. So do yourself a favor. Do a mitzvah. That's a good deed. Don't be a schmuck. Stop by the Projection Booth website and give us some feedback. Swing by iTunes. Make sure to subscribe. Leave us a review there. You know, 5 stars, that's a good one. We like that. And when you do, we'll say,
wonderful feeling!
An absolute free life in an absolutely isolated place, far away from this civilization and culture of violence, without vote, without governments, and without borders.
Are you a hippie?
Right on.
In American hippie Israel, tell you how I feel. Give me that microphone and I will give you the real deal. The economy, it sucks and it ain't getting better. What? Used to be so easy, drop some skills to get the cheddar. But everybody's crazy, fat, dumb, and lazy. Me, I'm in the back with anarchists and hippies blazing. Right. Walking through Brooklyn in a daze is amazing. But the city made me cave in. Fresh, depressed, malnourished, and undressed. Standing on the corner of 53rd and Lex. Come on. Waiting for the checks, waiting for the roll. That's right. Time to pack my shit, go through and pay the toll. They looking at me funny, as if I set a fire. She's 65 years old and can't even retire. Damn. And here I am, an old hippie has been. With my guitar, trying to sell some aspirin.
Yeah.
On the beach, be free, do what we want. Create our own society, communities, and restaurants. Walk around naked, totally free. Yeah. Experience the pleasure of your own destiny. Uh-huh. One that you created, it wasn't dictated. What? So many people hate it because they cannot make it. New York City, where'd you go? I used to cop it, I'm get high, then go down to Soho. Feeling like a Navajo, stuck in mad traffic, yo. What else can you do, though? It is what it is, bro. That's what they say, but you never see me ducking. It's this distinction that keeps the suckers sucking. So come on, girl, let's make our own world up in Israel. Yo, come on, girl. So come on, girl, let's make our own world up in Israel. Yo, come on, girl.
Right on.
Yeah.
Talk about,
come on, girl. You know the time is right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Talking like pack of bags of cold meat.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Talk about, go to Israel, baby.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you a hippie?
Now you know why I bum around, trying to run away from this stinking world. Right on.
The only sounds that are coming out of this place will be those of song, joy, and laughter! World, you're so full of shit.
How does it feel to be completely free at last?
Absolute free life.
absolutely isolated place, far away from the civilization and culture of violence, without hope, without governance, and without order. Right on.
The one thing that I still haven't done, which would be really awesome, is to do, you know, that Chemical Brothers song where it's push the button.
Oh,
the
yeah.
World, the time has come to push the button. So I want to just do a remix of that, just made out of snippets from the film. That would be awesome.
Let me tell you something, baby. You must have heard of the Vietnam War. Man, I fought hard for 2 years. 2 years of living hell. All I saw was death, killing, and acts of terror. And things that the sickest mind couldn't imagine. And the worst of it all, the orders. Can you imagine taking young people and telling them, you have to kill the enemy. And if you don't do it, the enemy will kill you. What I couldn't understand was why. Why did I have to come all the way from the States to shoot people who I never knew? And why should I come all the way from the States to fight and die in a country that's not mine? I killed my first one at 19. I stopped counting after that. I killed with my bare hands. I was like an animal. That's the way I was taught to behave. You understand? I was ordered. I was forced to do things I didn't want to. They turned me into a murdering machine. You understand? Me at 19, a murdering machine. You might not believe this, but at 19 I was still a virgin. Yeah, virgin. Hadn't slept yet with a woman, but I killed. I killed God knows how many. Buddies of mine died right next to me, gasping their last breath with, why? Why do we have to die here? Now you know why I bum around, trying to run away. Run away from this stinking world. From the society that turns us into messengers of doom, into robots. A push on the button, we are forced to run to our death. A push on the button and we shoot people. A push on the button and we are turned into wild animals. You fools. Scum of the earth. Shitheads. Creeps. Pigs. World,
the time has come to
push the button.
World,
the time has come to
push the button.
World, the time has come to
push the button.
Red,
my finger is on the button.
Stop pushing buttons.
My finger is on the button.
You fools.
My finger is on the button.
Fool.
Push the button.
Stop pushing. Man, I feel really turned on. I feel like I'm flying in the air and laughing at the whole world.
Yeah! Wonderful feeling! Wonderful feeling! Wonderful feeling! Wonderful feeling!
Men, let's get organized and find a place in which we can live as we see fit. Without clothes. Without governments.
Without wars. Without violence. Without machines and buttons. The only sounds that are coming out of this place will be those of song, joy, and laughter! Yeah!